Klamath TMDL implementation program with Mr. Clayton Krieger. that's a challenge. All right, Clayton, you got to make it real dynamic because Bill.
Okay.
Bill, you got to get.
I know
keep
I've
awake.
Gone on too long. If he gets up for his third cup of coffee, I'll cut it short. All right. Clayton Krieger with your staff scientist, TMDL implementation lead for the Klamath Basin. My talk here today is to provide you all with an ongoing update. It's informational item. Some things for you to consider in the long term for the future, but not asking for any decisions here today. I do appreciate the time you've given me. It's longer than normal. The basin is very complex. There's a lot going on. We're covering issues in both California and Oregon. But more than that, there's a little bit going on there that may have some implications for some elements of the program that we may want to look at for future expansion to other areas of the Regional Water Board activities. So we're going to take a little time on that today as well. Before I start, though, there's a name not up there because she's not on our staff, but she has been working with us for the last few years and has been responsible for a lot of the progress that we've been making. It's Chantel Royer-Kreider. She works through contract funds with the Humboldt State University Research Foundation, and she couldn't be here today, so I just want to give her a pat on the back and some acknowledgement. A fair number of these slides are her doing, and she deserves the credit. So with that, get underway here. Okay, we have a lot of topics today, and I'll try to speed through many of these. I want to go over the strategic overview. You've seen it before, but I think it's important to hammer home those critical elements of what's guiding our activities up there. There's many elements of the TMDL program that we will not address here today that are ongoing, some of which you heard about today, so they will not be included here, but I wanted to show a list of those and briefly touch on those. The last time I was here, I spoke about a water quality workshop. Well, that workshop has been held, and it's now moving into the next phase of a conceptual feasibility plan, and we'll be touching briefly on those topics, those projects that were evaluated at that workshop as part of that workshop. We have an exciting grant opportunity I want to bring to your attention. That's the EPA STAR grant. And now that it's been submitted, we have some EPA folks in the audience, and when I spoke to them in the past, it was known as the grant that will not be named because they couldn't be aware of it at the time. But it's now in the public realm. And then I wanted to update you on the KHSA, the Klamath Hydroelectric Settlement Agreement, Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement, a very brief update on the status of that. There are some elements of our PacifiCorp TMDL implementation and some coordination that we've been doing with the Bureau of Reclamation and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And then I want to touch on some program elements that we've been developing up there that I mentioned previously may have some application to other locations within our region. So first off, it's a bi-state project. I spend really most of my time above the border in terms of my implementation activities currently because that's where the big loads are. So we have a comprehensive basin strategy that's supported by memorandums of agreement, and we're developing agency management agreements that reflect this comprehensive basin strategy. We're establishing partnerships. Partnerships are a key element of what we're doing, and those partnerships are being established through sub-basin watershed groups. So you see up here, if this works today, each one of these sub-basins, we're hoping to establish watershed stewardship groups in each one of those. We will be covering later in the presentation, more specifically, the watershed stewardship group that we're working on in the Shasta. we are mitigating lost ecosystem functions and legacy pollutant loads. I'll be covering that in the next couple slides. So with this TMDL implementation strategy, You've seen this map before, and this map is visually pretty complex, so I'm going to use the pointer a lot here. This upper left-hand corner, that's the historic range of freshwater wetlands and marshes in and around Upper Klamath Lake. And this is, right now, this is the current condition. So you can see a large percentage of the freshwater wetlands and marshes, which are nutrient-retaining land use, have been converted to nutrient-exporting land use of rangeland and farming. And so that's part of our challenge, is that we need to reestablish those functions without utilizing the same footprint, the historical footprint. So we have to do it on a smaller, with a smaller amount of area to use. The bottom left-hand corner is Lower Klamath Lake. You can see there that the loss of freshwater wetlands and marshes is even more extensive, and with the result of a large amount of nutrients that are exported rather than being retained by that land use. So in addition to that, historic practices, logging practices, resulted in a large mobilization of sediments into Upper Klamath Lake, and that the approximately 40% of the nutrient budget of Upper Klamath Lake, which drives a lot of the water quality conditions on the Klamath River, are mobilized from the sediments of Upper Klamath Lake. So we need to figure out a way to deal with that legacy load. And then the third element, the third key part of our strategy, is that we're continuing to work with existing agricultural sources, you know, through our stewardship programs. So getting to that, those more traditional elements of our program, which I'm not going to talk about here today, this is a list of them. The Agricultural Lands Discharge Program, which you'll be receiving an update on soon. And you've heard discussion of the private and federal and timber permit programs, one of which I had a workshop on today, the Five County Roads Program, the Thermal Refugia Protection Program, which is largely covered by the ban on suction mine dredging in the river itself right now, and the temperature policy, which is under development, and the Shasta and Scott TMDL waivers. This is the part of the program that I spoke about last time. We were having the workshop. We had the workshop. It was quite successful. It was extremely rigorous. We had 115 people, experts. And when I say experts, I mean people who work and live on the ground and are very knowledgeable about what's happening on the ground there. Scientists from agencies, universities, regional scientists, national and internationally known scientists. And we worked in small groups of 10 at the workshop and addressed specific set of questions related to technologies. And the final report, the conceptual feasibility report, will be out by the end of March, first week, middle of April. And it'll address the potential of each one of these technologies that we evaluated at the workshop. And I'm going to go through those pretty quickly here. These were the six basic technologies that were identified by our 13-member steering committee that was broadly representative of a lot of the groups within the affected area. And we addressed each one of those at the workshop, and they will be more extensively described, and the potential for using them for pollutant reduction in the upper basin will be addressed in the final report. In addition, I want to cover I want to go back. What did I do here? Yep. Okay, there we are. This project network design. No one of these technologies is in itself the silver bullet. It's none of them are the magic bullet. They're going to exist within a network of projects. Not one of these can address all of those issues that I addressed in our strategic strategy, either the ongoing pollutant sources, the sediment legacy sources from Upper Klamath Lake, or the loss of ecosystem function from the loss of freshwater wetlands and marshes. It's going to be some combination of these, and that's what we mean by project network design. And this report will address that aspect of this as well. So one of the ones that came out of this, which is most promising, and I'll probably cover in the most detail of all of these, we call diffuse source treatment systems. And essentially what they are small treatment wetlands from 1 to 5 acres. And they're promising because they can fit within the footprint of existing agricultural operations without interfering with their operations. They have a very low permitting threshold in terms of water rights and other endangered species issues. They have very low engineering threshold, so there's a low cost in terms of their design, and there's a low cost in terms of their implementation. There's not a lot of infrastructure. There's not a lot of energy needed to maintain them as well. So the weakness of these is that they need to be replicated in many places throughout the watershed. No one of these, no 10 of these, will solve the problem of excess nutrients making their way into Upper Klamath Lake. It's going to have to become a fairly widespread practice amongst agricultural operators up there. And part of what we're trying to do is address the cultural and economic issues associated with implementation of this strategy we're calling the diffuse source treatment system. Treatment wetlands and wetland restoration, again, we're limited because in terms of the size of the footprint, because it is not our desire, our objective, or in fact, contrary to that, we do not want to displace existing agricultural operations. We want to work with the local community and the operators that are there. And so a big part of this will be treatment wetlands. And the reason why treatment wetlands are important is because the processes are more concentrated, and you can remove a larger amount of phosphorus and nitrogen on a smaller footprint than a traditional wetland if you have an engineered component to it. The issue is that they're more expensive, they do take a larger amount of land, and there may be some water rights issues associated with the use of treatment wetlands that may make it more difficult to get them permitted. There are wetland restoration projects occurring, and it's sort of a continuum. There is no such thing as once a wetland and marsh is lost, it's going to take some engineering to bring it back. And so what is a treatment wetland and what is a naturally restored wetland becomes a more difficult question than you might imagine. The Nature Conservancy is in the midst of finalizing the purchase of another 1,900 acres in the Upper Klamath Lake Basin for a wetland restoration project. And their attendance at the workshop shifted their thinking to how they might, in the past, they simply just flooded the land and let nature take its course. There have been some lessons learned from the research up there that if you take some engineering steps to restore a natural wetland, you can more quickly restore the nutrient-retaining functions of that wetland. And so the workshop has already had a very beneficial impact in that they have changed their strategy. They've hired a contractor for converting this 1,900-acre parcel into a restored wetland, but they'll do it in a way that it more immediately contributes to the nutrient-retaining functions that we would like to see out of these wetlands and marshes. This is one that we actually have someone in the room today. Dr. Diaz is here. He is working on this through one of the interim measures, but we evaluated it on a broader scale. There are many different designs, aspects of this. And this is removing algal biomass directly from the water column. One of the sources of water quality issues is the large amount of algal biomass that's generated by the algal blooms within Upper Klamath Lake is then transported downstreams. There are water quality impacts both for Upper Klamath Lake, the Lost River drainage system, and the Upper Klamath River as a result of these massive algal blooms. In addition, if you're able to filter this algae out of the water column, it could help break that cycle of mobilization of nutrients out of the sediment bed as well. So you could interfere with that cycle in a positive way by removing those nutrients, and the nutrients are mobilized out of the sediment bed under anaerobic conditions. And the anaerobic conditions come about as when you have these nuisance algal blooms, they reach this point where they they collapse and they filter to the bottom, and the decomposition process creates this low dissolved oxygen condition, which allows nutrients to be mobilized out of the, the mass. So this is a promising one. It does have some issues related to endangered species because the larval form of the endangered species could be a life stage, could be interfered during the filtration process. So some of these that looked more promising at the beginning of this process, we've gotten into them. We understand there's some complexities with them as well. So this one is still very much deserving of a pilot project, but there's going to need to be a proof of concept before this one is expanded to a fuller scale application. This one also has the possibility of creating a revenue stream at the back end by creating a product from the harvested biomass, either as a soil amendment or as material for a biogas operation or some such operation. And the feasibility analysis report will look at those potential revenue streams on the back end of this operation. Sediment sequestration deals with if you can trap the sediments, the nutrients within the sediments using either alum or other compounds that essentially lock it from being moved into the water column. And this is a promising one because that 40% budget could be greatly diminished. The 40% of the nutrients that get into the Klamath River from the upper Klamath Lake from this internal mobilization project could be cycle could be greatly reduced if we were successful at finding a strategy for this sediment sequestration. Again, you're interfering with the sediments, which is also the food source, benthic macroinvertebrates. So you have to be very careful when you intervene in the ecosystem at this level. And there is some concern about alum, which has aluminum in it, and under certain conditions can be toxic to species. Even though alum is used in most drinking water supplies, there is some potential in an uncontrolled natural system for toxicity to be present from its use. So again, this one is a pilot project. It's worthy of a pilot project, a proof of concept level of type of project, but it's not really ready for full scale application yet. So it's being looked at in that light. Sediment dredging has some of the same issues as sediment sequestration. You need to be careful when you're interfering with that element of the ecosystem. It's so important to creating much of the food source, the base of the food web there, as you know, along with the phytoplankton, but a lot of the food source comes from the sediments. There are life cycle elements of the fish. The one thing we do have is we have an improved map of the concentration of nutrients within Upper Klamath Lake sediments that has been produced through research conducted by USGS. And through that, it would be feasibly impossible to dredge the entire Upper Klamath Lake. But we're looking at it in a pilot project sort of way. Can we target certain areas of Upper Klamath Lake for potential dredging? And again, this one is also deserving of pilot project, proof of concept, but not ready for full scale. And then this is an example of what I meant. We had at the workshop, I mentioned we broke down into groups of 10, and that was so that people tend to not participate as much in larger groups. So our strategy at the workshop was to break people up into groups of 10 and assign them either a technology to evaluate, which was done during a certain part of the workshop. In the latter part of the workshop, we spent half a day. We gave them an RFP, a hypothetical RFP that had a certain amount of money. It had certain guidelines for how to satisfy the RFP, certain criteria we would be looking at with the goal of developing a large-scale water quality improvement program for the upper basin, you know, for a certain amount of money. And we asked them, given what you know now about these projects, design for us a water quality improvement project for this amount of money. And every one of the groups, this is Design Charette 10 or 9. We had 10 groups. And I chose this one as an example. They each came up with somewhat the same, but in varying in some degrees. But one of the things that was common was none of them put all their eggs in one basket. You can see each one of them allocated to different types of projects at different locations in the basin. And that's what this strategy is going to take. It's going to take multiple projects in multiple locations, sequenced over time, and it's going to take a long period of time to bring this system back into equilibrium and improve water quality. I think that's the point I wanted to make there. Now, following the workshop, we really had no idea where the money was going to come from for these pilot projects or these proof of concepts. And within a week after the workshop, EPA released an RFA, basically a request for proposal for Centers for Innovation for Nutrient Management. And we immediately glommed onto this opportunity, and with the idea that the Klamath Basin represented an ideal place for demonstrating innovative strategies for nutrient management, because we have ongoing nutrient sources and we have some very complex legacy nutrient sources, which is really the case across the country. Usually when you have highly eutrophied systems, it's not just existing sources that are causing the problem. It's some kind of ecosystem impairment or legacy pollutants that have to be addressed as well. And so we created a partnership between the Oregon Institute of Technology and Humboldt State University and the Klamath Tracking and Accounting Program and the Klamath Basin Monitoring Program. And we wrote a grant for the full $2.5 million. And we were able to, we had to identify matching funds for 10% of that, $250,000. And with our partnerships that we'd established throughout the basin, we were more than able to, we exceeded that threshold of $250,000 for the matching funds. And so we recommended projects for pilot projects for these diffuse source wetlands. We'll do pilot project where we actually put into place four diffuse source wetland systems to get some experience in how you design them, how you implement them, working with landowners. Floating wetlands, because if you think about it, that's one way we can address the footprint problem. If you have wetlands floating, it's not taking up any existing land space. You have them floating within the lake. It's worth a pilot project. And then we have the walking wetlands and sociocultural perspective on wetlands. And by that we mean, how do ag operators view transitioning some of their productive lands, and how do you create economic incentives for them that are attractive for them to convert some of their lands into wetlands? And we have it's an ag economist working on that particular project, and we're going to need to solve that part of the riddle as well. So we included that within this. And the acronym here for our proposed Center of Excellence is the Center for Investigating Nutrient Dynamics and Ecosystem Rehabilitation, or CINDER. And that is consistent with the fact that the soils of the upper basin are volcanic cinder soils that are rich in nutrients, nitrogen, and phosphorus. And we acknowledge that within our approach here, that we're existing in an area that has a tendency for productive waters, but can they be managed in a way that they can maintain water quality conditions that support beneficial uses? Then I wanted to touch briefly upon that a lot of our activities have been sponsored and funded by the interim measures under the Klamath Hydroelectric Settlement Agreement and the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement, and they continue to, the agreement was to come to an end as of this March, and it was amended, which extends the deadline for the potential for federal legislation or at least federal hearings on the agreements, which are still necessary. And there were refinements to the basic elements of the agreement, but essentially they're unchanged, including the water quality provisions. But the potential for congressional action remains uncertain. And we do have members in the audience here today, Mike Belichick, who is a senior fisheries biologist who has participated in these agreement discussions from the very beginning, and I don't know if he's free to comment on that, but I'm certain that he has better information than I was able to come up with on the status of the agreements. We may hear from him later. Okay. So as part of our TMDL implementation plan, there was the hydroelectric project, and Pacific Corps submitted their Interim Measure 11 Water Quality Pilot Project Tools as the first part of their commitment towards the TMDL implementation plan. And within that, these water quality projects have been partially funded by PacifiCorps, and we've been making good progress on each one of them. You can see some of them are actually the organic matter or the in-reservoir water quality treatment technologies, which included an algicide treatment, which was somewhat controversial. I think we'll be able to manage that better the next time around, and a rubber curtain, a rubber barrier for the migration of microcystin downstream to help manage the liability associated with the blue-green algae blooms. So those are ongoing. The funding decisions on the next steps for those projects has been delayed for a very positive reason, that being that the completion of the conceptual feasibility analysis report may better help inform how those monies, the remaining funds, should be spent. What I mean here by implementation coordination is we made a commitment in our TMDL implementation plan to an agreement, a management agency agreement with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Bureau of Reclamation to work on a program for water quality improvement in the Upper Basin. And we have made pretty good headway there. We have a letter of commitment from USBR and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to participate in this program. We've had our first meeting in December, and we have a plan for bringing in additional stakeholders because anything we do will be along a watershed stewardship model, which was fundamental to our agreement, and it will require the participation of others who may be affected or need to be involved in the solutions that we develop on that. One very positive thing that has come out of this is USBR has already given us or committed $50,000 to the development of the Klamath Tracking and Accounting Program, a decision framework to support that watershed stewardship group in the Upper Basin, and we're finalizing that agreement, and that those funds will also be channeled through the Humboldt State University Research Foundation and support those efforts. We have the Klamath Basin Monitoring Program, which is still benefiting from the $500,000 a year that PacifiCorps has committed through Interim Measure 15. We essentially have monitoring stations, both baseline and trends, and some public health monitoring from the Link River through to the estuary. And that's a collaborative program with the tribes participating and actually being funded to collect water quality samples, as well as PacifiCorps and USBR participating in that program. And that enhances our existing network of KBOMP. We have we have two meetings a year with Klamath Basin Monitoring Program, organizational meetings. We have it coming up in March. We have 2 days of speakers of very high technical quality, and that's coming up in March 20th and 21st. And I just spent the day responding to requests for people who would like to speak at that program. And it just illustrates the desire to get good scientific information out there to help start supporting decision-making in the Klamath Basin. And KBOMP has, I think, really increased the profile of that for the basin. We're continuing to build the Klamath Tracking and Accounting Program. We have finished our protocol document version 1.0, but we are still very actively conducting outreach. I have been scheduling meetings with the tribes, in the lower Klamath tribes, to participate and become a part of the Klamath Tracking and Accounting Program. And we have a 319 grant, existing 319 grant with the Klamath Watershed Partnership, which is establishing the Klamath Tracking and Accounting Framework for the upper basin, those upper watershed basins. And then we have submitted a 319 grant to establish a local lead for the lower basin with the Shasta Valley RCD. So we're making some headway there as well. Just to remind you, the Klamath Tracking and Accounting Program is the other part of the Adaptive Management Framework. Adaptive Management, KBOMP, monitors the baseline and trends, you know, water quality conditions as they are within the basin. The Klamath Tracking and Accounting Program, this is something we've done very poorly in the past. It measures the management inputs. You know, what are the things we're doing to improve water quality? And not only just project by project, but project, what did we expect out of that? What was the temperature improvement we expected? What was the nitrogen and phosphorus removal that we expected? And so the Klamath Tracking and Accounting Program will provide a lot more rigor to that input so that we can really ask the question, what were we expecting and what did we get and what changes do we need to make? And that's illustrated in this next slide. And that's what I mean by Klamath Adaptive Management Framework. You can see a cycle of activities there where you implement actions and then we certify and register these projects within the Klamath Tracking and Accounting Program. And then through KBUMP, we begin to monitor these water quality conditions based on what were our expectations for improvement. And then through our watershed stewardship teams, we can make the adjustments that we need to make to move the program along. And so with that, I just mentioned watershed stewardship teams. And I would like to focus on that in the next few slides because that's becoming sort of the central locus of activities within the Klamath watershed are these watershed stewardship teams. And by that, you've seen this definition before, and I didn't want to change it. Some people had recommended some modifications of this, but I wanted to be consistent here with what we had seen before, which is, in general, it's the careful and responsible management of something entrusted to one's care. And you can see that that could apply to a wide range of objectives, including water quality, water supply, agricultural operations, biodiversity, and fisheries. And really, our first within the state of California here, within the Klamath Basin. The Shasta Valley RCD was our first local lead entity. Their board self-nominated themselves to be the local lead for the Shasta Valley. So this is the process by which we're following there in the Shasta Valley, and this is the process I think holds some promise for bringing together a lot of entities that can combine resources to get more done in a more efficient and effective way. And the first step in this process, as you can see, it's ongoing, but the first step is to build partnerships. So right now what we're doing in the Shasta Valley is we're reaching out to all the entities, like the Montague Water Conservation District. I went to their meeting the other night, asked them if they would be willing to participate in a monitoring program with us, and they're considering that right now. The next step is to characterize the watershed. Do we really know what's happening there right now? Have we actually looked at the most current information? What are the temperature trends? What are the water quality trends within the basin? And we're building that database from all the sources that collect information within the watershed right now, and we'll better be able to answer that question once we've assembled all of that data together. Then working with that, with those who've agreed to this partnership approach, we will together begin to identify problems and develop solutions. And by that, I mean as a group, as a stewardship group. And then we agree on implementation actions, and there's the potential there with this group having identified these problems and solutions together to better able to combine our resources, such as the $50,000 grant from the Bureau of Reclamation for establishing the Klamath Tracking and Accounting Program in the Upper Basin. And so they're implementing these solutions. And the current solutions, there are already ongoing implementation actions in Shasta, and I'm going to use one of those in a minute as an example of this. The next step in this stewardship process is to evaluate and measure progress. And that's the monitoring program. That's where the monitoring program comes in, and you've registered these projects, so you know what you anticipated. Now what are we actually seeing in terms of improvement? And the next step then is to make adjustments and move back out to your implementing solutions and make the changes that you need to make to make sure that you either have ongoing success, or if you're not having success, you make some changes to make sure that you will in the future. So how do we document all this? And this is where we move into the 21st century and using 21st century technology to better communicate not only to you, but to the public who is involved in this, and back to other agencies that have oversight to us, the State Board and EPA. You know, right now what we do is we write reports and we send them back to a few people who look at them and either approve or disapprove of what we're doing. What we're talking about here is having a web-based program where the watershed stewardship for the sub-basins, that we have a wide range of natural resource objectives, but water quality primary among them here. And the regional board participation would vary by sub-basin. In the Shasta, we have a primary function. We're close partners with the Shasta RCD here. And what this will do, what I hope this slide illustrates, is that it will streamline a lot of our reporting requirements. This habitat, this colorful wheel here, are a whole series of priorities that have been identified by various stakeholders. We haven't rigorously evaluated them yet. They are simply a list at this point. But the stewardship process, that characterizing the watershed and identifying problems and concerns, we would narrow that down to a few projects. In this case, we did that for tailwater return flows, and we did it for Parks Creek. We identified Parks Creek as a critical area for tailwater return flow projects that have been implemented within the Shasta Basin, and we've seen dramatic improvements in water quality temperature within the reaches where we're seeing those projects implemented. And so this is an example there of before that was some of the tailwater return that was going into Parks Creek and had temperature load. It was increasing the temperature within Parks Creek. After the tailwater return flow project was implemented, you see the after result of a much reduced flow into Parks Creek. All of this would be, a person would be able to go on the KBUMP website and work their way through those slides and actually learn about this project and the project results as they work their way through the slides. And this would be an open wiki source, so it would be dynamic in that anybody who is a part of the watershed stewardship team can upload information, make modifications that would then be monitored by our basically Chantel to ensure that it was a legitimate change, but that these, a lot of different people would have opportunities to provide information on the watershed stewardship process within this program. So that brings me to the end here. And I just want to emphasize that we have been having a lot of success, but it's largely been due to collaboration and partnerships. We have not, other than my staff time, we have not really committed a lot of our own funds to this program because they aren't available. So we've had to work with others to convince them of the benefits of making their investments in these water quality, and we've been successful in doing that. So the other part of this I'd like to emphasize is we need to build the adaptive management framework. We build confidence in the process when people see that you're tracking what you're doing and that you can demonstrate the intended effect and whether or not that intended effect was achieved or not, and you can make a reasonable decision about what to do about it if you're not. And I just want to say dam removal remains a key uncertainty, but it has not really affected our work in the Upper Basin here. And I just hope that this, the example of this template has demonstrated that there may be some potential application for it in other parts of our work in the basin. With that, I'll take any questions.
Hey, Clayton, go back to the Shasta for a minute. So Shasta has a TMDL waiver program in play, and so this becomes an implementation part of it, but it also is a bit separate from it at the same time, right? I mean, it comes in after a TMDL waiver has been in play now for, what, 6-7 years or something like that. This puts in a monitoring plan to check and verify and amend and adapt. And so how does this jive with a waiver program and TMD outcomes? Does it? I could see that it's very complementary. It supplements the information set, though.
Right. Essentially, what the RCD saw was that there was a need for that structure. You saw the rings, that there were you need more continuous engagement with those who were involved in the waiver program.
Absolutely.
And the programs. And so when they came to us, they actually heard a talk about this approach at the K-Bump, the Klamath Basin Monitoring Program meetings, and they came to us and they said, we need a better structure for working with our stakeholders in the basin, and our board would like to nominate themselves. We'd also like to be able to better report the good news, all of the good conservation projects that are being done by individuals who are willing to provide that information. And so we would like to be the locus for the Shasta Valley. We would like to be the local lead implementers for the Klamath Tracking and Accounting Program.
But step forward some. I mean, you know, so there's an implementation plan that's already in play on the Shasta, and we just renewed the waiver, and there's some intention about going forward out there. And this does get at some different stuff out here, right? It supplements and it changes the contours of the implementation of TMDL out here. At the same time, it also puts in a mechanism of measurement and check and verify that really is not in place now.
That's correct.
So, and I mean, outcomes here, take that a couple steps forward. This really could, I think this is a very good thing, by the way. I think this puts in many of the pieces and parts with TMDL that really should be there, it seems to me.
I think what it does is it expands the forum in which people can engage on these issues and keeps more continuity in them moving forward. And it does make it more rigorous in terms of being more precise about what actions are actually being taken, what's intended by those actions.
Well, and I think maybe as it should, right? I mean, it's a temperature-impaired system, and we have done as an agency and required work to be done out here to try to get to unimpaired conditions, and we have a temperature model that was based on, you know, the knowledge at the time, and that work's been going on for a long time, and there's been a considerable amount of work out here that has been done and continues to be done. And then this comes in and puts a measurement, a mechanism, and then takes – this seems to me to be a great step forward.
Well, and remember what this does too is KTAP is a program independent, or at least we're only one party to it. It's not a regional water board program. I mean, I've put a lot of energy and investment into it, but you saw our charter members up there include a lot of different groups. And it provides the pathway for independent certification of waiver requirements. But if somebody chooses to do that.
Well, and to back that out a little bit more, you know, identification of the Shasta as a sub-basin to the Klamath, right? It connects the Trib and a very important cold water Trib to the main stem here, right? It connects the head bone and the neck bone kind of thing, right?
Well, if you think of from a beneficial use point of view, which in this case are salmonids, they use the entire system. They actually use the main stem for just certain parts of their life cycle. And without the sub-basin activities being coordinated with the main stem activities, you could not be doing as much, you know, you were really optimizing the program by including everything, making sure that you do have refugia for the fish to go to and spawn in and things like that.
But also, again, to look at the whole piece of the pie there, if I did my math right, charette number 9 added up to over $400 million.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a pretty big big burrito.
You notice, though, that they did leave out $50 million for contingency, that they did not actually find a need to apply all of it in that first round. And this was over a 20-year implementation period.
That was my question. So you're talking, did you, in essence, give them a $500 million budget for 20 years and say, just dream big, and that's how that came about?
Right.
Okay.
And the idea there being that through this stewardship framework, I know it sounds probably ridiculous right now, but the idea is that, you know, through this coordinated action, that you multiply the resources of many and focus it, you know, through these efforts so that you can consolidate funding from various sources. That's part of the market created by Klamath Tracking and Accounting Book Program, by creating actual value for the environmental credits, allows you to have different entities pay into large projects that they themselves would never be able to fund.
Well, at the same time, it kind of desegregates a system, right? That it doesn't just look at the system as one little sub-basin, right? It looks at the pieces and parts as a whole and starts to get at some of this. And then it also gets down to the level of landscapes where you're doing work in Parks Creek, which is an important cold water reach of Shasta, and it gets into a TMDL implementation and maybe changes or forms that in a different way than it is now.
And it also makes it not just one agency's operation. I mean, you do have to do a lot of convincing. You know, it doesn't mean that regulation goes away either. I know some people have interpreted partnerships and stewardship and collaborative efforts as meaning that there's no regulation. You know, that's not true. We do have our bottom line, the law that we have to uphold and maintain. But I find that we could make a better case and negotiate for it. It's almost like community policing. Police operations that don't just hunker down in their stations but get out in the community and sell their program. Why is it a good idea to follow the law? How does it make a stronger community? Have been demonstrated time and time again to be more successful than those that just hunker in the station and do battle. So, I mean, it's a shift in philosophy, but it doesn't mean it's a shift away from our traditional tools.
No, I don't think so. I think it actually dream big and you know, dream a lot and kind of go for it. And it seems to me that this, I mean, look at just the Shasta in Parks Creek. It could be as concentrated as that, or it could be as big as, you know, something to take Upper Klamath Lake and do something on, say, the Williamson River or something like that. I mean, this is big water scale stuff.
And, you know, we are seeing a more, I mean, I don't want to tout too much the grant that we got from USBR, but I mean, a year and a half ago, they weren't even returning our phone calls or emails. And I think we've made a lot of headway there in just being willing to work with them on a kind of a partnership level. So, I mean, we can pound on the door or we can entice them to come out and play. I don't know. So I think we're having more success with the latter rather than the former.
Any comments or questions for Clayton, you guys? Mr. Massey?
There we go. Just a couple quick questions, Clayton. On the TMDL implementation elements, the thermal refugia and the mining stuff, where are we in the state of California now with dredge, suction dredge mining?
Is it appropriate for me to call upon Michael Belichick? Mike, do you know anything about what's going on with the suction dredge mining?
I don't have special knowledge.
Gail? Mike? No. Well, right now, last I looked into it, Bill, there was, Sam? While the permit was being written, there was a ban on suction mine dredging, and that was probably the most disruptive activity for thermal refugia. If you remember, we had protection zones within that, and right now the suction mine dredging has been banned as a result of that ongoing development of those permits for that until
my understanding was that it was through the governor's office, so it wasn't us and we weren't.
No, right. It wasn't a result of our activities. So we benefited from another source of authority on that.
Real quick on diffuse source treatment systems and the idea of going to small rather than trying to replicate what was there originally. Do you have any idea about the proportionality of how well, or are we too young yet, or?
We're a little bit too young. The report, the feasibility analysis report will give an estimate of the required number and size and scale, but not the location, because then we're infringing on, you know, private property rights. That would have to be the decision then of the landowner, but it will give an estimate of those locations that are ideally suited or meet the parameters for those, but not the location of them. But we will have an area total, and we will have an estimate of the pollutant reduction potential from if those were fully implemented down through a series of scenarios, you know, down to a small number. They've proven quite successful in the upper Midwest, which is where they were pioneered. Dr. Bill Mitch at Ohio State University first came up with this program of just inserting a small infiltration wetland within existing agricultural as part of the Gulf Anoxia project, the upper Mississippi drainage into the Gulf. That's where these came from. So
Cool. How and then finally, and it's just a it's a wild guess, because 3 to 5 years ago, we were just barely starting this process, and the thought was that we would never get anywhere with it. And you and the people that you have assembled have gone a long, long ways. Do we have an idea of where we are in the spectrum of revitalizing the Klamath River after 100-plus years of destruction?
Well, I think where we're at is there are a lot more people who recognize that we will never get back, you know, to where we were, but that we will get back to a point where there are supporting conditions, you know, for salmonids and other endangered species, and that it wasn't always this way. I think the sediment core studies by U.S., a lot of the science now demonstrates that there has been change over time, and those changes, there were negative water quality effects. There are a lot of people who now believe that, yes, it was once better, and there's many more now who believe there is a pathway through a network of projects like that that will get us there. I think everyone recognizes it will take, you know, a long number, you know, 25 years, 30 years for all these things to come together and make the Klamath, you know, whole again. And a big uncertainty in that is the fate of the dams, which, you know, is really a long way from being settled.
Thank you.
Any other comments or questions? Please keep us informed, as you've done, Clayton. I mean, I'm amazed just at you know, you being in the middle, you know, of all this great big wheel, and that the work that's gone on here. I know it's not just you, that it is many others out here, and it's a collaboration. I was here when, you know, the Klamath was passed and the TMDL was adopted and was part of the hearings to get to that. And, you know, it's of such huge magnitude, it's really kind of hard to wrap your head around some of those numbers of reductions that were called for in that TMDL. There, you know, you look at that kind of stuff, and it's an amazing process just to kind of watch it get off the ground. I do like the fact, again, that this reaches into some of these sub-basins up here, the fact that this is going to be the mechanism, it sounds like, that's going to get into the Shasta and have a, you know, a monitoring plan that gets at TMDL in a way that wasn't being done perhaps in this way, right? And I think that's a very good thing. I think that's a net positive that comes out of this and connecting these sub-basins together into one whole watershed.
Well, I just want to emphasize that the RCD approached us about that, and I think it in large part because of the great working relationship they have with Andy Baker, and a lot of those projects I mentioned as implementation projects were already underway, and they were seeing some success there, and I think that promoted the willingness to, you know, so it's not, you know, I presented it in kind of a linear way. You build partnerships and you work through those steps, but it's a lot messier than that.
Oh, sure it is.
But
looking at a TMDL, see, I think it's interesting, though, in going through the Shasta and Scott recently, it's quite interesting to me. I wasn't here when they were adopted, but I was here, you know, I've been here long enough to be able to see how at least some of the work that's been done and reported on and things that are efforts going forward. It's interesting with a TMDL, like on the Klamath, to lay something out. This is our intent. Here's the numbers we're talking about. And they're just so big, you know, they're just so darn big to even wrap your head around. And yet it's interesting to look at a TMDL like the Shasta and Scott, where you have the benefit of hindsight and foresight. What happened in the last 5 years, and where do we want to go in the next five? This adds a layer onto it and connects it together, again, in a way that is really interesting, I think, as far as you know, having feedback mechanisms, measurement, different shade of implementation or a different type of implementation, but it still is within that context of TMDL implementation. It retains the RCD, and I agree with you 100%. Shasta RCD are pretty much rock stars in my book.
Yeah,
to do the kind of work they're doing, and others too, by the way, others that are out here swinging the hammer on this stuff and trying to make it go. I really thank you for your work.
Thanks. I think to have the credibility in the future that to ask for money, we're going to need to track better how we used it and what the effect was. And I think that's really one of the bottom lines here. And we shouldn't be afraid of that because we know we can have a positive impact.
Very nice work, Clayton. Thanks. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time. All right. With that, we have one agenda item left. We have item number 9, which